Designers in Film, presented by Mike Dempsey. For me, it was the set of Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, designed by Ken Adam in 1964, that has had a lasting impact on my memory. The vast constructivist-influenced War Room set, with its extreme triangular shape and central oval table, illuminated by an elegantly suspended light ring, described by Steven Spielberg as the greatest set in cinema history, is masterful. So it was a great privilege for me to have had the opportunity of interviewing Ken Adam just a few years before his death. When newly elected President Reagan was being given a guided tour of the Pentagon, he asked to be shown the War Room and was disappointed to be told that it didn't exist. The set for that film, along with 75 others, spanning a 60-year career, including 7 Bond films, The Ypres File, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and the Oscar-winning duo Barry Lyndon and The Madness of King George, both the set design, were the vision of my guest today. Ken Adam is the doyen of 20th century film set design. His work has inspired countless designers and architects around the world, and his life is every bit as glamorous as the films he has designed. His family fled the Nazis from their home in Germany, and once settled in the UK, Ken Adam, along with his brother, were the first Germans to be allowed into the RAF, where they flew Typhoons in the Second World War. He is also a lover of fast cars and exotic locations, and has been responsible for some of the biggest and most expensive sets ever built. I spoke to him about his life and work at his home in London's Knightsbridge. I want to start, Ken, with really your early sort of inspiration. I think it was the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Right.
With those extraordinary expressionist sets by Herman Worm, I think it was, that really inspired you onto your career path. Why was it so influential?
I don't know, because I was at the time never quite sure whether I would go for the theatre design or for film design. And I felt Caligari gave me a sort of interesting compromise, because it was designed by a number of expressionist artists, very stylized, very theatrical. And I said, well, you know, I was very young when I saw it. I was, I think, 13 or 14 years old. You know, I loved it. I loved the combination of the theatricality and realism. And I saw it when I came to England. I didn't see it.
So it was after you came over to England. You were 12 when you came over, I think.
13.
13. So you saw it at that time here.
I saw it, and I also saw Metropolis.
Of course.
Which impressed me. You know? So I was very fortunate, because in Berlin I was not allowed by my parents to go to the cinema. I was allowed to see Schiller or plays and so on. But the only film I ever saw was a film called Schanger. I never forgot it was a nature film in which there was a horrendous battle between a python and a tiger, and I've never forgotten it all my life.
Of course, you came here to escape Germany and the Nazi regime, and then later, of course, you joined the RAF along with your brother, Dennis. I think I'm right in saying that you were the only Germans accepted into the RAF at that time.
I think so.
And went on to fly Typhoons.
Yes.
And I saw a very lovely drawing of your Typhoon that you have reproduced in the book, the Christopher Frayling book, which clearly was showing your artistry at that time, very detailed. As we've got so much to squeeze into the little time that we have, I'm going to select a few of your many films, specifically because they have a resonance, I think, with a wider audience. And I think I have to start with Dr. Strangelove. I think that's got to be... Yeah. What I'm interested in, apart from the fact that that set, the War Room set particularly, which I know Steven Spielberg has rated as the best piece of cinema production design ever in his view, I'm interested in the relationship between director and production designer, because it seems to me
that, you know, when a film is in its early stages, you know, the production designer particularly and the director, I mean, if we put the writer to one side for the moment, but that really is the visualization process of the film.
Yes,
and so I'd be very interested in how you first met Kubrick, how that came about.
Kubrick phoned me. He'd just arrived in London. He was staying, I think, at the Westbury Hotel. And he had seen Dr. No, and he was really impressed by Dr. No, so he asked me to come and see him. And we hit it off. The first impression was it's somebody with enormous vitality and so on, but rather naive, which is not true, you know. And we got on a house on fire, but then eventually you found out this enormous brain, computer brain almost, that he had. But at the same time, incredible enthusiasm. So when he more or less explained what he was going to do, I was doodling some ideas. And he was so impressed with the doodles. He said, that's it, that's the war room, you see. So I said to myself, well, you know, this great director who everybody's so scared of, easy. Little did I know.
Well, you could, of course, that was the focal point of that film, the huge light ring and the table with the circular table with the president and everyone surrounding them with those dramatic sort of triangular exaggerated perspectives with all of the with the the whole world there to see. And I know that I think President Reagan actually thought it existed when he was being shown around the Pentagon. He wanted to see that. Yeah. So it's obviously stuck in the mind of so many people that have seen that film. The areas of that film that I also find, because I actually went last year to the BFI during the Kubrick season, and they had a very good print, Strangelove, and so I was able to look at it in close quarters. And, of course, the thing that I was amazed by is that you actually recreated all of those interiors of the B-52 bombers. And because of the nature of the way they were shot, which is sort of semi-documentary style, which seemed to be, it was very interesting, because that seems to occur later in the film, when the base is being attacked. It's handheld cameras,
Which Kubrick shot, you know, himself. Yes. Yeah.
It had that. But likewise, inside the cockpit, I thought it was actually inside the real plane.
Right.
You meticulously put those together without having...
Well, it was on the secret list.
Exactly. How did that...
Well, we found a lot of information in Jane's aircraft or whatever it was. I also had a fantastic assistant art director. It was called Peter Merton, who unfortunately died 2 months ago. He was brilliant at sort of researching things and finding old panels and or switches and so on. We decided to go for 100% realism on the B-52, and it was very funny when some American Air Force personnel visited us at some stage in Shepperton, and they went white, you know, how did we know all this? And I got a memo from Kubrick, I hope I know where I got it from, because we might be investigated by the CIA. And it is the interest, I think, exactly what you were talking about, that you got the war room, which is complete fabrication and so on.
And had a surreal quality.
A completely surreal quality. And why I think it was one of my most successful sets, because it fitted so well the dramatic impact of the scenes, and all the actors felt completely at home, but in a strange way, you know.
Yes.
So it was a set which really mirrored what Kubrick had in mind or what the film had in mind. In that sense, I think it was one of the best sets I ever designed. And, you know, I started off with a different design while we were doodling. And Kubrick liked that for about 3 weeks, and I drove him every day to the studio. And one day he said, Ken, I don't know what to do with the second level, because I had two levels, rather like a little bit like an amphitheater. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Stanley, you're the director, you know. He said, well, I don't know what to do with the second level, so come up with something else. And I really nearly flipped out and went for a walk in Shepperton Gardens, you know, in the studio. and then came back and after taking a volume or something like that and started scribbling again. And he was standing behind when he saw this triangular shape that, well, a triangle is the strongest geometric form, isn't it? I said, yes, certainly. And he said, well, how are you going to treat the surfaces? I said, that's reinforced concrete. So like a gigantic bomb shelter, yes, and that's how really
I see the whole and thing. And interestingly, looking at that set, it does have echoes of the Caligari, some of the Caligari,
yes,
you know, that dramatic, exaggerated perspective.
Expressionist.
Of course. Did you get close to the actors at all, or was that... Because obviously Sellers was such an important part
of
that
project. Yes, I'd known him before, Peter, socially. And mind you, one never got very close to Pete, but we were friends. So Peter I knew very well, and George C. Scott I got to know, and Sterling Hayden as General Ripper. I got really close to Terry Southern, who was the writer.
It was quite crazy, but fantastic.
And I never forgot... The first time he came on the War Room, and I said to him, well, what do you think of it? He said, well, looks interesting, but will it dress? You know? I mean, it's sort of completely idiotic. Like I said, that's all you're going to have. But he always used to, I mean, he knew he was saying something.
He was antagonizing. I know that. That collaboration had its stresses and strains, but it was clearly a landmark piece of work. And later you were offered to work on 2001, but you turned it down because Kubrick had been secretly talking to NASA.
Yeah, not secret. He had advisors, really.
Working. So why did that did that obviously...
Well, I tell you, because I felt I have to know as much about space and subject matter as he does, but only in that case I can assert myself or my ideas rather, because I can argue with him. But if he knows so much more than I do about space technology and so on, he will destroy me in a way.
So it puts you at a great disadvantage.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed to me, from what I've read about him, he seems could be a rather secretive fellow and wanting to share his thoughts, even though it would have been probably very beneficial to, you know, share the ideas.
Yes, maybe. But I think in his whole, certainly professional life, he was very secretive. Mm. You know, he used to... never go with a second unit on various films.
No, and a little later I want to talk to you about another film you worked with, but I want to move on to one of my personal favourite films that you designed, which is The Ipcress File in 1965. I particularly like it because I think it seemed to me that, you know, there was a prolonged period, post-war period, where everything was rather dowdy and sort of drab. And this film came along, which was sort of antidote to Bond, really. Bond was much more glamorous and fantasy, whereas this was rooted in a kind of reality. And I know that Len Deighton himself worked in that area as a translator, I think, so knew that world very well. But what I was interested in is the opening sequence of the film in which Michael Caine, he's getting up and he goes into his kitchen, which is a very trendy kitchen. I mean, it looks as good now, in fact, because there's been a 60s revival, you know, the low-level lighting and so forth. It looks terrific. Everything else in the film was very grim. And I thought that really introduced the character, that he was a young guy, he could cook, the lighting was beautiful, the interior was beautiful. And yet, of course, you then had to reintroduce all of these other areas where he worked and the sort of rather austere, colourless rooms. I mean, that was a big contrast. I know that you worked on many productions, obviously, with different characters, but this seemed to me to be almost a kind of, as I say, antidote to Bond.
You know, yes,
you
it was.
Dealing with the minimum rather than the maximum.
Yes, Harry Saltzman never saw it, certainly initially as that way, because he saw it as a really poor man's Bond, and we were very much against it. Sid Fury, myself, and a producer from New York called Charlie Casher, and we fought Harry all the time about it. And it was, I think, Michael's second film or third film and so on. And he was on our side all the time. And the kitchen was also part of Len Dayton, who was also interested. So I designed that kitchen inside the existing, I think, building, and made Michael a little bit of the Len Dayton character with his cooking and the acting.
Because Dayton was writing the cookery, strips, I think, in Observer. And also he went on to write cookery books as well as, obviously, the Ipcrest one.
And we always had to fight Harry on this not making it a poor man's Bond. And I will never, maybe it's too long, the secret, but I found this house in Grosvenor Place, and it was Victorian or Edwardian, and big house, and had one very big room with three windows at the end, beautiful proportion. And I decided to use it for M's office. Oh, it wasn't M, it was
MI5. I've forgotten his name, but I know who you mean.
And Harry was also impressed by it, and he said, can any dressing you want, computers, any modern equipment, I can get it for you. And I thought about it during the night, and I thought to show this disciplinarian who was running, and it would be much better to have it empty, have a trestle table as its desk, and a camp bed on the side, and maybe a bust of the Duke of Wellington or Caesar. And Harry came, and I sold the idea to Sid Fury, and he loved it. And while we were shooting, Harry came on the set, and he blew his top only as Harry could do. And he said, I was trying to go between him and the director, and this is all that sort of thing. And you know, a film unit loves these sort of rows. They all disappeared all over the place. And then about 2 hours later, Harry came back and said, I think it's a good idea. But it was that sort of film.
Yes.
And it was great because we had a wonderful old cameraman who started his career by filming the funeral of the Emperor Franz Josef, you know, on a handheld camera.
Oh, really?
It was more for Otto Heller. And his operator was very good, too.
There were some very good compositions.
Yeah, very good compositions.
Very unusual.
It seemed to
hit the note of the time.
Absolutely. It somehow all worked.
It did work. It stands up very well. Yeah. After you'd said, actually, I think that you wouldn't work with Kubrick again, you actually were persuaded to go back in 75 and this time to work on Barry Lyndon.
Right.
Which, again, I'd seen last year at BAFTA, a new print, and you know, was astonished by its beauty still.
Yeah.
Wonderful film. And the interesting thing about that, I think, is that you talked a little earlier about the fact that Kubrick would never go on second unit. In fact, he didn't leave the country, did he? He stayed very much rooted here. And you found yourself in a position of actually making rather more decisions, probably, than you would normally be expected to.
Yeah.
Even, I think, did you direct any of the second unit yourself?
No, I think I may have done one sequence because of a house in Ireland which he thought was haunted. And so he didn't want to be near it, nor did he want his two daughters to be anywhere near it. It was just an establishing shot or something like that. But, I mean, if I talk about Berlin, then it'll take us till tomorrow morning.
I think, you know, it's a magnificent film visually. Mm. And again, looking at it last year, it is just, I mean, certainly, you know, the fact that so much of those interior shots were lit by only candlelight and that lenses were developed, fast lenses to be able to capture that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for production designer, that had its own, and a DP, its own problems.
Yeah, enormous
dealing
problems.
With that.
Yeah, we were all talking in terms of candle power.
Yes.
Because we used to import candle, treble wick or double wick, you see, depending. One didn't realize the trouble it caused, particularly since Stanley wanted to shoot everything in location interiors, you know, and on location. And the heat given off by these candles was enormous. So in some of these stately homes, we had to design heat shields out of aluminium and so on today.
Because of fire hazards, I guess, as well.
And that, you know, with beautiful paintings on the wall and so on. So it created enormous problems, but it was a wonderful idea. And I must say that for Stanley, he always came up with an original or brilliant idea on every film he made, you know.
And of course, you received an Academy for that film, for production design. Mm. So it was worth you hooking up with him again. But the interesting thing about it is that I find there is another film that was made just a few years later in 1979, which is remarkably similar in feel, and that is Ridley Scott's first film, The Duelists. Have you ever seen that film?
No.
Well, I watched, I actually designed the title for The Duelists.
Oh, really?
Watching Barry Lyndon last year, and I hadn't seen it for a long, long time, and then re-watching The Duelists, the similarities are remarkable. The opening.
Oh yes, I now remember. Yeah.
Opening shot is a duel.
Yeah.
And there's lots of candlelit scenes and lots of beautiful interiors. So I think that it's clear that Ridley Scott was very taken by the beauty of that film.
Yeah.
I want to move on now to the most remarkable body of work, which is all the innovative design work you've done on the seven Bond films. Obviously, we can't talk about them all, but I mean, they became more and more ambitious. And you know, you had the spectacular missile launching pad hidden inside a volcano in You Only Live Twice, which I think was the biggest set
ever built.
And then, of course, you had the pyramid room in Moonraker, which is another epic. I would have thought that dealing with that sheer size of production must have given you an enormous stress at times. I know that on Linden you were under enormous stress.
I had a breakdown, actually. Yes. But, you know, there are so many other reasons for that. But I was under stress on those ones like You Only Live Twice and the later one. But you have to remember I had a fantastic team with me by this time. You know, we were a great family, and they were all good. Mm. And my construction manager, Ronnie Udell, was unbelievable. Mm. And, I mean, he made that famous statement to a journalist of the Observer implement that came to Bynemouth. And the journalist asked Ronnie, how is it you can build all these things that this man designs? And he said, quite angrily, anything he can draw, I can build. And that became, you know, but it was true too.
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's wonderful when you have that kind of
collaboration. Yes, I had a great team.
I mean, it makes life so much easier. Mm. I mean, of course, you trained as an architect, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. But not the full training. No.
But I think you, again, one of the architects you admired a lot was Eric Mendelssohn.
That's
the modernist architect. And of course, in fact, a couple of years ago, I was working for the Weizmann Science Institute, which is just outside Tel Aviv. Mendelssohn built the house for Chaim Weizmann, so I visited that house and saw that.
Incredible.
And then, of course, here in this country, they've recently renovated the Delaware at Bexhill-on Sea, which is Schirmeyer and Mendelssohn.
But it's also, it was interesting because, you know, I was also articled with a firm of architects and engineers, C.W. Glover and Partners. And one of the junior bosses was a man called Quine Lay. And he had been associated with Mendelssohn. So even though I was studying at the time as an external student at the Bartlett School, which was very traditional in those days, and I was going, you know, through hell. Mm. But Quine Lay always pushed me, you know. And I think the professors, even like Richardson, who then became president of there, were like talking to me because they spent more time with me in the evenings, you see. I grew up in that sort of environment. And I also, in some of my spare time, did some working drawings for, or sort of drafting for a group called the Marths Group, which were a splinter group of the Bauhaus in England.
Yeah.
And so I came very much in touch with modernistic ideas and architecture, even though in hindsight something occurred to me again because I saw the Bauhaus exhibition in Berlin and it's now at the MoMA in New York and it's fantastic if you ever get a chance to see it. But it didn't go down too well in England. I mean, when these architects from the Bauhaus came here, and I remember one designed a private house in Frognal in Hampstead, and it didn't get great reviews and so on. And they finally all ended up in, or most of them ended up in the United States.
Mm.
It was a strange thing.
I want to move on to the other kind of passion that you've had over the years, which is motor cars. I mean, your Rolls Royce is sitting outside there, beautiful as it is. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one has to talk about the Aston Martin DB5 that was used in the Bond films. And and it was you that, of course, designed the ejector seat and the scythe and the machine guns. And from what I understand, all of those things worked.
Yes, they did work.
They all worked.
Yes, but that wasn't me.
No.
We had a wonderful special effects engineer, Johnny Steers, at that time, who anything I came up with, he went better on, you know. Obviously, you couldn't have real machine guns and so on, but, you know, it was, he was brilliant. And I was very fortunate with him and then later on with Derek Meddings, who also was a brilliant special effects director and model maker and so on. So I was very lucky that eventually I had a fantastic team with me. And I felt nothing was impossible, and they were too proud to admit that some things maybe were not quite that possible.
You, of course, the other car that you designed is the car in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which you've referred to as that bloody car. Why is that?
Well, I tell you, I found in those days very easy to design futuristic vehicles of any description. And I thought anything. And suddenly to find myself designing something of the turn of the century that time, you know, and make it look sexy and interesting, I found very difficult. And I kept doing sketches after sketches. And then we built an actually full-size mock-up at Pinewood. And I say recently, and it must be now 15 or 20 years ago, I met someone in Canada who was working for me as a carpenter, and he said, "You, Ken, you have no idea. You drove all of us crazy with your changes and so on and so on, until I felt I got it right." And then it was built by Alan Mann, who had a racing stable, and Ford put up the chassis and engine and so on. But you have no idea how much correspondence I still get on Chitty Bang Bang.
Well, I guess because, of course, it's now a very successful musical and touring the world, and I suppose it's it's created a great interest in that, and the car is iconic. And I remember at the time of the film, they made models of the car.
Yeah,
too,
that's right.
So it's stuck in people's mind. And of course, in the theatre production, it actually is flying
over the
audience, which is quite incredible. A big shift for you was being approached in 2003 to work on a computer game, GoldenEye. Uh-huh. I'm not a games person myself, but I did look through many of the images on the game itself and the sets that that you've designed in that same way. And obviously, I think that, and this was, you know, the whole computer gaming world is advanced enormously. It advances, you know, rapidly year on year. 2003, the renderings then were not as good as they were now. But I think what I'd like to talk to you about, something we touched on just before we started this interview, is the idea of creating a complete world rather than, you know, sets where cameras will be in a specific position and you know what you've got to cover.
Mm.
But in computer games, it's a different thing altogether.
Yes,
do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, this computer game, I think, was dealing with Goldfinger or something. I can't even remember the name of it, but it had
Goldeneye.
Yeah, Goldeneye. Mm. And they came up with, you know, design for Fort Knox based on my sketches and so on. Mm-hmm. Then I found out that when I did, you know, sent them my renderings for the new Fort Knox, that I had to deal with things which I didn't do with the film, because in a computer game, people have to hide, they fight, they go behind things, through corridors or passages and so on, which was completely new to me. Mm. But I didn't mind that so much. But I was so disappointed when they sent me the first DVDs over of what they'd shot. I couldn't see the gold, you see. And I said, what's happened? You know, I stacked up gold like a cathedral inside a cathedral, 40 foot high. Now I see crates with sort of bits of gold looking. He said, Ken, because we can't yet get the reflective surfaces of gold. Those days are good. Now they can.
Absolutely, yes. 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 They've made an enormous advance in what can be done.
And well, every day.
I think, you know, on that topic, of course, you know, we've got the Oscars coming up this weekend, and no doubt Avatar will pick up quite a lot of awards, I should think, which is now the advance. I haven't seen the film, but it's 3D computer-generated imagery, most of the film, with live action as well. Yeah. What's your view on because obviously CGI is something you probably embraced here with this game, but not in your film world so much. Everything was built.
Yeah, everything was built. Well, I started very limited use of CGI on The Madness of King George for Windsor Castle and one or two films before then. I can't think of them now. But I think it's a fantastic tool. It's fantastic. But I think it can be overused because, and also the production designer really has less control, because even though you can sketch out every sequence and set up sketches or continuity sketches, normally you are not kept on after principal photography. And so it's left to all these various CGI companies who do it. And I must one day talk to Stuart Craig about it, you know.
Yes, like, yes, of course.
Because he's very much involved in that. But I found every time I used it, the director 3 months later called me and said, you better look at these CGI because I can't, they're terrible and so on. And even so, I'd sketched it out and given them they came up with some different ideas, you see. But, you know, every day the most incredible progress is made. Mm. But the danger is that a film relies too much on this new invention or new tool. And I always think that when a director or a designer or anybody was limited, he had to use more his imagination very often to come up to give the impression of 100,000 people attacking. Something like that.
Of course.
Nowadays it's so simple. It's, you know.
They just
well, I don't want to discuss Avatar because the Oscars
of course.
Are
not. No. There is another film out that's just been released called The Road, where, from what I understand, no CGI has been used.
No,
but there's some fantastic sequences which are just brilliant. Yeah. And you would think that it is CGI. So it can be done, and it was made on a far smaller budget, obviously, than that. So do you think that computer games is an area that you would be happy to work in again?
I don't know. I mean, I was surrounded with Electronic Arts, and I went still to L.A., by a lot of young, very enthusiastic people, and they have formed into teams, and each team works on something. And I was quite excited that they, you know, respected and admired my work, because I used to send it on an old fax, you know, my sketches and so on. And but it's funny you should mention it, because I had a phone call last night or the night before of somebody who was in charge at Electronic Arts, who then left Nobody that I worked with is still there, because the hours are so incredible, and they have no restriction. And he's working for Disney, and has been working for Disney for some time. He asked me, would I be interested to come up? He thinks for some space ideas and so on. I don't know.
Well, it's that's good. I think the last film you completed was The Out of Towners, which is that right?
Yes.
About 11 years ago.
Yeah, it was not the last film I did, but, yeah. But no, I did one called Taking Sides after that.
Yes.
Yeah. In Berlin.
Right, okay.
Was the Ron Harwood about the denazification of Fort Wengler, the conductor in 1945, I think it was. And István Zabó, the Hungarian director, directed it in at the UFA Studios in Berlin, and I designed it. And actually, it's a very good film, but it came out, unfortunately, was shown at the Toronto Film Festival at 10:11, a day after the disaster of 9/11.
Oh, I see.
And everybody
left it. Yes. I know that you also designed feature of the Berlin Millennium Pavilion, which was the futuristic structure inside and you ran into difficulties there, I think, because one, there was a date that it had to hit, but you'd come up against something you hadn't come up against before, which I think was things like health and safety and planning.
Right.
And planning issues, whereas with all your Bond films, you could just build and no one's going to...
You're absolutely right. I don't know where you found this out, but it was a big problem.
How did you deal with that? Because, those things can be very tricky.
Yeah, very tricky, and particularly also in Germany with the pedantry of everything. The elevator had to be, and oh my God, and the glass gantries and so on. But we went through somehow, you know, and I quite enjoyed it because it was a scientific, really, exhibition in the Martin Gropius Bau, which is Victorian, and I tried to keep the Victorian feeling in the background, and then came up with a very modern 70-foot-high structure and steel and so on. And building, because I knew nothing really about various like brains and
the spiral.
Yeah, what is it called?
Oh, DNA, of course. Yes, DNA. The double helix.
Double helix.
Yes.
And I'm 70-foot high out of steel. Yes. You see, and it started off with a diameter like that, and then came to almost nothing.
Yeah.
And I had some brilliant young sculptor and the outskirts of Berlin who did it for me. Wow. So it was, in a way, a very successful exhibition. And I was forced to exaggerate things because I didn't know enough about science. Mm. But so do it oversized and so on. Mm-hmm. So that the public were really standing like that when they saw it.
Mm. Clearly, over the years that you've been designing, you've had an influence over, you know, generations of designers in different disciplines. And, for example, Norman Foster, the architect, he has said that he based his Canary Wharf underground station, really, which is inspired by your Atlantis set from The Spy Who Loved Me. And I can also see echoes of your work in younger designers like Mark Newsom and Ross Lovegrove, and in particularly Zaha Hadid, the architect, whose work, and Daniel Libeskind as well. All of those, when I look at their pieces, I see always the sets of Bond or Strangelove. But I think it seemed to me, looking back at the time of of all those classic Bond sets, I kind of get the impression that your work was rather overlooked by maybe the architectural fraternity. And
yes, I don't think, You know, did you see my Serpentine exhibition?
I did, yes.
And it was the first time, really.
It was really
art
celebrated.
Yeah.
And I think that was because a younger generation of architects at a particular time were taking the inspiration from maybe the childhood visions of things that they'd seen, particularly bomb films and so forth, and feeding that into their work. And this kind of interests me because you know, as with anything in design, you have these stylistic shifts. You know, there's a time for minimalism and there's a time for maximalism, and postmodernism, and all of those things. But I think there's something very powerful about being inspired at a young age. It stays with you, and then later, much later in life, it starts to bleed out of you. And that's what I feel about these particular designers. I think those images created in your films, burnt on their sort of retina, and they come out. I particularly think Zaha did in particular. In fact, I've got a couple of pictures, although we can't see them here, but I want to show you these because I think you'll be interested to see. Mm. So here are a couple of here is one. This is Zaha Hadid.
Oh yes,
that's I think a wine, part of a wine cellar company. And this is another. This is an interior. Now this, look at this.
Yes, yeah, yes. But you know, while the exhibition was on, a lot of architects came to talk to me and said what I wear, how much I had influenced them or other architects.
Yes.
And I hadn't been aware of that. You know, I was too much involved in
Of course. On a frivolous note, and this has nothing to do with design, but I think it's an amusing story. Mm. Perhaps you could tell us how you got to go to bed with Barbara Streisand.
Well, that was very funny. Yes, it was on a film called The Owl and the Pussycat, you see. And in New York, we did it in New York, and the actor who was supposed to... Barbara played the hooker,
you know. Yes, sir.
And to pick her up in the street and so on, and he was ill, and Barbara insisted that I would play the part. And Ray Stark was a producer. Her brother was the director. Ray came to see and said, "You've got to do this." And I said, "You must be kidding, you know." And but at the same time, somebody had to pay $2,000 to my union in New York. So in the end, I thought, man, also since I knew Herb Ross so well, and Ray said, you're not going to do anything and so on. I did it, but it turned out to be 3 nights of shooting, you see. And the funniest thing was when I rang up my wife, Letizia, who was staying at the Stanhope Hotel, and said, "I've got to go to bed with Barbara while George Segal is watching from a window next door." So she said, "What underwear and socks are you wearing?" And we had to send a car to the Stanhope Hotel so that I changed my underwear and socks. But I never went to bed with her. She was the one who had, and my God, the problems we had, the stage had to be cleared and so on. But it was a very, very funny sequence, actually.
Do you go much to the cinema these days?
I see a lot here.
I suppose you get all of the BAFTA and Oscar screeners to watch.
Yeah,
What's your view of cinema at the moment now?
Well, I think, you always get good films. Mm. And just because of what you were saying about CGIs and so on, yes, you're amazed at what can be done. Mm. But you find that a film which maybe, I don't want to quote any actual films, but which is... a normal film which is well directed and well acted and well staged is just as important or more important, you know.
Yes.
So technology goes ahead, obviously, but I think it normally is a mistake if a film is purely reflecting technology. Mm. Because, you know, also I worked or grew up with actors, whether it was Olivier or Noel Coward or whoever, and Marlon Brando, and they were very much influenced by the setting in which they were.
Of course,
and the props. And
well, that's
so
a very interesting topic, because I interviewed Anthony Powell, the costume designer, some years ago, and we were talking about the the fact that the effect that clothes have on an actor and how some actors want to inhabit the character through the clothes first, the shoes, that whatever. But likewise, I think the world that you create for them must have an enormous emotional impact on their performances. So I think it's these key elements that can create the reality of a world. So I can quite understand actors being, as you said at the beginning of this interview with the war room, for example, I'm sure that the actors entering that space would feel completely different. Because it was so extraordinary. Certainly Sellers gave such a wonderful performance, not only as the president, but as Strangelove, in that scene in the wheelchair.
The big problem was for the other actors to keep a straight face.
So I gather, because I believe a lot of that performance was improvised, which is...
But Peter used to improvise a lot, you know, and because I knew him before Strangelove. And I think it started Kubrick on doing so many takes on future films.
Which he was notorious for.
But with Peter, you know, you never knew. I mean, he came, it was unbelievable. And if you watch Strangelove closely and you see Peter Strangelove and say, you know, yes, my Führer or something like that.
I can walk.
I can walk. And Peter Bull is standing next to him and he can't keep a straight face.
Of course, that the originally that film was going to have a custard pie. Which was shot, wasn't it? And then it was it was removed.
Well, I think there were various reasons for it, but we all, including Stanley's family, tried to make him use it because it was brilliantly done and so on. And he absolutely also was the time of the assassination of JF Kennedy.
Of course,
there is a line of dialogue, how can... you know, our president be struck down, because it ends with Peter Sellers as the president and Peter Bull as the Russian ambassador sitting like children on the walnut floor, building sandcastles out of the custard pies, you know. And so Stanley thought that you know, nothing could force him to use
it. It ends on a nuclear explosion. Well, you see, prior to that, I think Slim Pickens riding the bomb
down,
which is a very strange, rather sinister shot because of the nature of how it was done. It looked like back projection or whatever, but it's suddenly very, very creepy. It had the sort of quality of some of those Hitchcock films where he seemed to use really obvious backdrops, but they seemed to have a strange, sinister sense of reality.
Well, I think what happened was that Stanley came up with this idea. I was always driving him to and from the studio, so I knew everything that went on. And Peter Sellers just wasn't any good as the bomber captain.
Yes, he was going to be that part.
And in fact, he sprained an ankle or... And Stanley came up with this brilliant idea of Slim Pickens, somebody he knew in California, and he got him over, you see. And then we had problems to get him accepted by the unions and so on. And I had built this gigantic full-size bomb bay of the B-50 and suspended it from the grid of the big stage at Shepperton. But I didn't have a practical bomb door, you see. And so I was in trouble because Stanley asked me that he has to shoot in 3 days or something like that. And I said, I can't do it, you know, in that time. Even if I work everybody day and night, we can't get it done. That I had a wonderful special effects man who worked with me before and who was then already in his early 70s, and he was called Wally Weavers. And when I was in trouble, I always went to Wally Weavers. And Wally Weavers always used to say, Ken, let me sleep on it, and tomorrow I come up with the solution. And so what he did, we took a still of the inside of the bomb bay, which was enormous, and then he cut out where the bomb doors would be, and we shot it partly against blue backing and so on. And the actual missile complex was painted by a scenic artist who eventually went to Disney. Mm-hmm. And so you have, and we suspended the bomb and then pulled back and eventually optically went in on the
missile. And that's what gives it this very strange, rather frightening feel.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end, but before I leave you, I wondered whether you have any pearls of wisdom for any young designer wanting to emulate your career in the world of film production design.
No. I don't know. I think they have to be able to assert their personality, because you have to deal with a lot of, you know, with the director, with the cameraman, and so on. And you have to be able also to dream, you know, and try and convince the director or producer if you feel there are some changes required or there are some new things you can introduce into the script. And so you have to have that personality. You obviously have to have talent and courage.
Well, I like that notion of dreaming. Obviously, many of your dreams have come to fruition, and they're fantastic too. Ken Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, it was wonderful.
Thank you.